And we're live.
Okay, yes, we're live. This is the Bogosity Podcast, I guess, for the 30th of November, 2016. That's not one of our usual dates to be doing this. This is very impromptu with very little planning. So sorry, no music, just dance to the rumba in your head. We're supposed to be in the middle of a two-week hiatus, but we just had all these stories piling up. So I thought we should at least try to get these out of the way so we could be free to cover other things when we come back. So joining me again is Ibrahim Zaloum.
Good evening, gentlemen.
And let's go ahead and get started with news of the bogus. To the age-old question, who would build the roads, in addition to all the other answers we've given over the years, we've got one more: fruit smugglers.
when these guys do a better job than the Russian and Belarusian governments, they should be the ones running for office, not Putin or... that Lukashenko guy or whatever. Yeah, Lukashenko. So,
yeah, I think that's kind of a low bar. But anyway, according to Alexander Lazhenko, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right or not, of the Smolensk Region Border Agency, there was a dirt path between Russia and Belarus that was upgraded to a full-fledged road, including widening, grading, passing lanes, and even interchanges, by fruit smugglers who recently had $200,000 worth of Greek and Polish fruit seized by customs officers.
Oh, why seize the fruit? I mean, how are the fruit smugglers going to maintain the road? I mean, they're clearly not the slackers here.
All this is happening because Russia has banned all European food imports in retaliation for an EU trade embargo over Russia's 2014 annexation of Crimea.
Oh, of course. So that people can get somewhat cheap fruit, they're forced to smuggle it across the border from Belarus.
Yeah, they don't like what the Russian government's doing, so they're stopping the Russian people from getting. I never understood sanctions.
They feel that by getting to the people, they undermine the ruler, I suppose. I mean, it rarely ever works. I mean, if it worked, why hasn't Cuba deposed the Castro regime?
That's true, and we've got a lot of that in the news now because of the passing of Fidel Castro. And
long may
I couldn't say it couldn't have happened to a more deserving guy, but anyway, that's one thing they've said about, you know, the reason for the Cuba embargoes is so that the people would revolt and overthrow Castro. But there were like what, 6 assassination attempts against Fidel Castro?
600.
600.
Oh yeah, 600.
Wow.
They really hated that guy. I mean, Hitler had 42 known possible assassination attempts in comparison. So I mean,
but that was over like 8 or 10 years, I think, as opposed to how long was Castro in power? 30, 40?
He was in power from 1959 to 2009. So
okay, so
50 years.
Yeah, 50 years, yeah.
Half a century. So, I mean, this doesn't say that Fidel Castro is objectively worse than Hitler. He's not, or was not. But at the same time, that's a lot of assassination attempts.
The point is, you don't really have to do much to convince people to overthrow a bad guy who's killing them. So I don't really see what the sanctions do. They're just not getting fruit, and so they're not as healthy, and so they can't run up as quickly and do it. You're making the most fit.
Actually, just gave me an idea. Maybe it's the case that they ban that the fruit importation is so that everybody has scurvy, so they're less likely to rebel.
Maybe.
Yeah. Start to rebel when your connective tissues are falling apart. So.
So anyway, they banned all European food imports. When that happened, the number of lorries crossing the Russian border from Belarus increased to 73,000 a year. So they're actually bringing in more fruit than they used to.
Wow. So, and bear in mind that prior to this, Russia was importing food pretty much like most socialistic countries, you know, or countries influenced by it. So the government has a direct control over it. So right. That really says something about the efficiency of these black market smugglers in comparison to the government. And this isn't to say that black market smugglers are inherently good. I mean, we've all seen what black market people can do. Anybody who's read about Pablo Escobar can relate to that. But it really says something that they are in many ways more efficient than the Russian government or the Belarusian government, which is supposed to be putting a curb on the smuggling, one would imagine, since it has close ties to the Russian government. But what do I know?
So you have local administration chief Sergei Listopadov, and he joked to the RAA Novosti news agency that he'd like to write them a letter of thanks for improving a road that before only a horse and cart could negotiate.
Yeah, I wonder at the fact that fruit smugglers can achieve in a year what the communist government and the succeeding governments could not achieve in about 80 years.
Yeah.
So.
I heard a comparison of this recently. It was like the Empire State Building was built in something like, 90 days or something like that? And the Freedom Tower, which replaced the World Trade Center, took 13 years?
I don't know truth of that, but it certainly does bring to mind the fact that government bureaucracy can hamper things. I mean, in Egypt, for example, which we'll be talking about, you have to fill an insane amount of paperwork just to get a house repaired. So,
yeah. Well, people on social media were liking the roads too. One of them said, quote, "At least someone is maintaining our roads." Another said the same thing. And some of them even suggested that the smugglers form their own political party and run on a platform of fixing roads and potholes in exchange for free trade.
They would have just created the first large libertarian party in a Slavic country outside of Poland. that would be a landmark. So, if it does come to pass, I wish the fruit smugglers the best of luck. So, as long as they're not murdering people.
Yeah. But Leshnenko isn't amused. He says they don't have the authority to destroy or block the road, so they'll have to be content with catching the smugglers outright, which means constant 24-hour surveillance.
Knowing these smugglers, if they're able to create a road, what's to stop them from creating another road to just get around the block the road?
Well, that brings us to this quote that I wanted to close off on, this complete win from AutoEvolution.com's Vlad Mitrace. I'm not sure if that's how it's pronounced, but quote, "This might prove to be a very clever plan. With that route blocked, the smugglers are left with only one option, upgrade another road. Soon enough, the whole region around the Russian Klemenki village will become a driver's paradise with not one penny of the taxpayers' money spent."
Wow, that's just sad. Yeah, hilarious at the same time. We live in strange times, that's for certain. So,
yep. So we talked about the Adobe breach back when it happened. Yeah, we're live, no music, sorry. Next segment. But we talked about how they did such a horrendously poor job of securing their users' passwords.
Mm-hmm.
My user account was one of them, although I randomly generate my passwords with LastPass, so I was never in any real danger, but several states, including my home state of North Carolina, sued Adobe over this breach, and now Adobe has to pay them $1 million. North Carolina's share of this is over $71,000, and I'm expecting my check in the mail any day now.
Really?
No.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, just think, $71,000, you say? It just might be enough to pay off one guy's student loans? I don't know.
So. I think it was really about making Adobe feel some of the pain they caused to others by this and giving the incentive to do better, which I think is what ultimately needs to happen. I mean, think about it. If your doctor reveals your private information or an attorney reveals privileged information, it's malpractice and they can be sued and forced to pay up. And the same concept should apply to anyone who holds any of our data that we deem to be personal and private.
If only we could sue negligent governments.
Yeah, that'll be the day.
So, but no, that's a good step in the right direction, at least. So I don't know if $1 million is necessarily appropriate in this case. I don't know the scale of the damages, but it's certainly a step in the right direction.
So. Yeah, I mean, just giving them the incentive, because no one likes paying $1 million. I mean, let's face it. So, and I mean, if the reason why they're doing this is just because of financial, oh, well, we'll save a little bit of money by using substandard or non-standard or outdated technology, then, you know, maybe this will give them the incentive to keep things up to date. I'm not sanguine about having it done by state governments, but making them pay some kind of restitution when this sort of thing happens just might incentivize everyone to do a better job of securing our user accounts. I mean, how many data breaches have we had this year?
Too many.
Yeah.
I mean, when an entire series of routers from China get hacked because they have about as much passwords protection skills as Spaceballs.
The kind of thing an idiot would have on his luggage?
Yeah, that kind of thing. Oh, the Druish king. There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. What?
That's literally what it was like. That the top, I think it was like 15 of the top 20 passwords were some variation on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Someone was clever, or like a bunch of people were clever, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, and they started over again. Nope. Not that clever.
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure out how Tom Lehrer could, if he wanted to, write a satire about this. I mean,
I know.
Gotten to the point.
Satirizes itself, you know?
Yeah, it's self-satirization. How do you write a satirical song about this? So,
when you have, like, I think it might have fallen off the list, but for a couple of years there, one of the top 20 passwords overall was, "This is secure." No, it isn't.
This is secure. It's like some sort of totemic prayer. This is secure.
I still love the fact that Monkey is in the top 20. I love Monkey. You gotta love that, because it just sounds so nice and random, and it isn't.
Yeah. Even when I was, I mean, just to give you an idea of how bad these passwords are, even when I was 18, I had enough sense to use relatively obscure things as my passwords, like random combinations of numbers, or if I needed to remember something, World War German gun designations, which could be ridiculously complicated.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, so I'm not going to mention which guns are involved, because some of my passwords, unfortunately, are still on those, and I've yet to upgrade them. But
I mean, with a little bit of just a consideration of who it is you're trying to hack, that can go a long way. I mean, there have been cases where law firms have been hacked because hackers have gotten these legal dictionaries, grabbed all these fancy schmancy legal Latin-y kind of terms, put them in their password list, and just ran right through them.
Exactly. And that's actually why I'm upgrading my password, because when you think about it, German gun designations can be looked up. So
yeah,
I've had to.
And now that you've told everyone that.
Yeah. So it doesn't matter. I mean, like I said, all the important ones have already been changed. It's just the minor stuff at this point. So I'm not worried. And again, it's only for some of the passwords, the ones that I need to easily remember. Most of them are nothing like that. So.
Just come up with one big, strong password, memorize that, and use LastPass for the rest.
Yeah, I suppose.
That's the way to do it.
I'm contemplating a switch to that, but I'll be honest, I'm too lazy.
So. They actually make it fairly painless, and it's why, I mean, you don't have to go through and randomize all your passwords right now, but you would want to do it with your really important ones, like, you know, Amazon, PayPal, stuff like that. And they have it where the popular websites, you just do it at the click of a button.
Yeah. So. And, yeah, it's just when you're a graduate student, anything that has nothing to do with graduate school or something very important gets hard. So you just get lazy about them. So, yeah.
All right, so this next story was a nomination by Neil Purcell for Biggest Bogon Emitter. Not so sure. I think the case is way overstated, but I think there might be a nugget of truth here. Basically, we have someone claiming Muhammad was a feminist.
Not by modern standards. 7th century, maybe. But yeah. Modern, no. So, I mean, the thing to keep in mind is that And a friend of mine actually keeps railing on about this whenever he talks about any sort of literary work, is that in this particular case, Muhammad was a product of the times. All right. Now, we can some out there will argue until they're black and blue about the metaphysics of it all and everything, but whether or not he was inspired by God is irrelevant. What matters is he was a product of his time, and he had to work within that time. All right, he doesn't have in and of himself the power to override people's natures and introduce ideal systems, even if he wanted to, which we don't know. It's been 1,400 years. All right, it's the nebula of history. But getting back to my point, he was a product of his time. And in that respect, he had to contend with and was part of a society which was highly patriarchal, highly authoritarian, which it still is in many respects to this day, and was pagan as well. So, and he's introducing, here he is introducing what essentially started off as a monotheistic religion, which in itself is a disguise for, if you want to look at it that way, a sort of minor revolution, but that's another story. So
it was in a lot of ways like a reformed Christianity to begin with, at least.
And you can see that in some of the mythologies that are inherent within the Quran. For example, you have the use of Christian, what the Christians call Christian apocrypha. So that's why, for example, in Islamic accounts of Jesus, first off, he's not the son of God. He's just a prophet. And second off, he's not directly crucified or crucified at all. So there are these differences. And,
so what this?
Go ahead.
Okay.
No, go ahead.
So what this, now you see the kind of things we added out here. So this HuffPo article says, quote, Sharia law has little basis in the Quran, and it is certainly not consistent with anything we know about what Muhammad taught or how he treated women. Of all the founders, actually, I want to get, before I read on, I want to get your opinion on that. What is the relationship to Sharia law and the Quran?
Complicated. He's partially correct. In every jurisprudence in Sunni Islam, for example, the fundamental and original source of jurisprudence, fiqh, as we call it in Arabic, is the Quran itself, because it's supposed to be the word of God. All right. Surrounding that would be, and it's not necessarily because there aren't many of them, are what are called hadith qudsis, which are supposed to be divine revelations that aren't part of the Quran. And then you have and this is collected with the sayings of the prophets proper in what's called the hadith traditions. So things he was supposed to have said or supposed to have done, him and his immediate successors. And then you have an outer layer of what's called of a variety of things, such as qiyas, which is analogy, you know, just trying to get through the laws using logic and all that, and so on and so forth. So it's kind of a layer cake effect. You have the Quran in the middle, and then you have everything else built around it. And in many ways, he is right in that the Quran is not as central as people might imagine, even though it is supposed to be at the core of jurisprudence. For example, the Quran has no mention of stoning adulterers. It doesn't mention anything about killing apostates. So, and yet, both of these are based on stuff from the hadiths. You understand? So,
not really, but
yeah. Well,
maybe I'll play it back again later, and I'll get it.
Yeah. So, to put another way, it really depends on the situation. Some things really are derived entirely from the Quran. Other things are not. So, because there's a hadith tradition that is built around the Quran as well. So, because the idea is if the prophet is supposed to be the living embodiment of the Quran, then you want to know what he said, and you use that as well.
Yeah. So the article continues, quote, of all the founders of the great religions, Buddhism, Christianity, Confucianism, Islam, and Judaism, Muhammad was easily the most radical and empowering in his treatment of women. Arguably, he was history's first feminist.
Well, again, let's count the improvements that he objectively made to the status of women in the Arabian Peninsula at the time. First off, prior to his ministry, he had you had a society that had very variable inheritance laws. Some places allowed their women to inherit; most did not. On the other hand, but in many of these tribes, there was also a case of where women could literally, wives could literally be inherited by the sons. So if it's not your mom, you can inherit your stepmom, basically. Then you also have what's called infanticide, which I believe is mentioned in the article, which tended to disproportionately kill baby girls. So
I didn't really go into that. Are they talking about exposure or what?
No, this was pretty brutal. What they would do is, it's called wet, which has a similar etymology for the word for chasm. So what you're essentially doing is you're digging a little pit, you're putting the baby in it, and you're burying the baby alive. Ooh. So.
Yeah, because exposure goes back to like ancient Greek times, maybe earlier. And the idea was for an unwanted child, the child would be born, and then you'd basically bring it into a crypt, you know, above ground, but you just set it down in the crypt and just leave it there to die.
Yeah, well, as far as we know, they didn't quite do that in Arabia. What they would do instead is they just bury the child alive. So.
Yeah.
I suppose the main reason behind that is the idea that out of sight is out of mind. So if you bury the child, there's no chance that you'll even see the corpse as you run by it. I don't know, but that was actually one of the things that was that's a common theme in the Quran. Actually, is the ban on infanticide. So it is what it is. But on the other hand, there are some things that people and I can see where they might draw. Conclusions where he took things a step backwards, like, for example, with witness laws. People have trouble understanding those. For example, it is very common in Islamic jurisprudences nowadays, partially citing the Quran, but also from Hadith traditions, to demand that for every male witness, you have to have two female witnesses. Now, the Quran itself is a little bit nebulous on the subject. There is a verse that talks about how if you produce a female witness, you have to produce basically an escort so that the person does not abandon their testimony. Which is actually why I pulled up the dictionary I mentioned to you. The word used, nesia, used to mean in the 7th century something used to have several meanings, one of which was to abandon your testimony or to abandon something or to drop it. Another meaning is to forget.
You mean as in recant, to go against it and say that's not saying anymore?
Yeah, that's basically it. And in the context of a patriarchal society, it makes sense to have escorts for women so that they don't recant, because in a patriarchal society, it's very easy for a man to use his leverage against a woman to make her recant or to withdraw her statement before she could actually give it, because patriarchal society for you. And so you can see this as a primitive form of witness protection. I mean, obviously, nowadays, we have better methods of doing this. We don't really need to do that. So, and the other thing that I can see people arguing as evidence that Muhammad was not a feminist by modern standards are the inheritance laws. Now, Sargon of Akkad, and this is something I'd like to call him out for publicly, he said that the Quran states that women inherit half as much as men. That's an outright lie. I'll be blunt. It's daughters who inherit half as much as sons, but not women as much as men. For example, a wife and a husband, or a father and a mother, legally have the same amount of inheritance in Islamic law as each other, regardless of gender. It's just the daughters and husbands. Now, you can argue, of course, that this is still very unequal because, you know, a son is getting twice as much as a daughter. But again, this is a patriarchal society. So, and by the standards of the time, it does represent a step forward in that it sets at least a minimum by which you hold it. But of course, by modern standards, this isn't very progressive, obviously.
Yeah, but I mean, it's always been, you know, incremental steps. I mean, you know, first feminists around, like, I guess, the early 19th century, you know, what they were talking about was only incremental steps, you know, give women the right to vote, things like that, but not, you know, equal say in the running of a household or things like that.
Yeah, it's something like that. So by the standards of his time, I would suppose he was quite a humane person. And if you take it in the spirit of that, then obviously the trend should be towards greater equality between the sexes. Now, the problem, of course, and this is a problem with all religions, is that when you have a law that's supposed to come from God, even if you understand that the spirit of it is towards equality, you start to think that the actual laws themselves are the main thing. Arguably, you take the shell and leave the kernel. And as a result, religions become, what's the word for it? They become calcified almost. They become rigid. And they hold people back, unfortunately. So.
Yeah. And I also couldn't help notice that all of the ones she was comparing it to, Buddhism, Christianity, so they were all centuries, if not thousands of years before Muhammad.
Definitely. So,
yeah. And I also thought it was interesting that she included Confucius, but omitted Lao Tzu. And Lao Tzu believed that Tao was only achieved, Tao is the Chinese character for the way, was only achieved when men and women are in balance with each other, both personally and in society. And I guess kind of the first real disciple, if that's the right word or whatever, of Taoism, the student of Lao Tzu who really got things going was Shuang Tzu. He took it a step further and basically said that any such group distinctions are misleading, because as soon as you, you know, Lao Tzu wrote, as soon as you define the Tao, you lose it. And Shuang Tzu applied that to these groups. And Taoism really resulted in an improvement in the status of women in Chinese society.
Though, of course, equalizing as it was, as I recall correctly, Chinese society remained highly patriarchal until very recently, actually.
Well, that's because you still had the legalists who were pretty much running everything, and they were about as non-Taoists as you could get.
And then you had the Confucianists, who weren't that much better.
So yeah.
They were okay. They were okay, but not as good as the Taoists, I suppose. Actually, it's a fun fact. In Imperial China, the government and many of the Confucian scholars actually had a surprisingly friendly attitude towards Muslims, because they saw a resemblance between the two. For example, Emperor Yong Le wrote a poem about the Prophet Muhammad about his virtues, which I found pretty interesting. So, yeah, I just find it fascinating.
And also, one thing to remember, if you go back and you read the writings of Lao Tzu and Shuang Tzu, and you're seeing all these male pronouns and stuff like that, I understand the original Chinese was always gender neutral.
Chinese, as I understand, doesn't have a strong grammatical gender, unlike Arabic or even English.
I think they have some kind of like modifier or something they can stick on if you need to specify the gender. I mean, I'm no expert or anything, but yeah, I think your basic pronouns and everything are gender neutral unless you specifically do something to specify it.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't comment on that one way or another. But I know they don't have distinguish between single or in plural, for example. So yeah, it's
right. They've got all sorts of weird little turns of phrases, like if you read the Tao Te Ching, you'll see all sorts of references to the 10,000 things. Mm-hmm. And you're like, okay, what are these 10,000 things? Well, 10,000 was just a euphemism for everything. For either infinity or unlimited or unspecified or something, they use 10,000 for that. So you see things like that all over the place.
So that's quite fascinating, actually. Anyways, going back to the topic at hand, I mean, no, I would not say that Muhammad was a feminist by modern standards. He may have taken things in the right direction, but at the end of the day, he was still very much a product of the early Middle Ages in terms of what he was able to achieve.
Yeah, and it seems to me that a lot of what he was doing was really getting back to where it was in the Code of Hammurabi, which, of course, was, what was that, 2,000 years earlier, maybe more?
Well, that's the thing. The Quran itself doesn't have much in the way of corporal punishment. There are three examples that come to mind. There's the punishment for theft, which... If there are certain qualifiers for it by tradition, but the punishment for that would be the amputation of the right hand.
And that's from the Code of Hammurabi.
Granted. And then there's the punishment for adultery, which is actually in the Quran. And that is, if you can prove it with four witnesses, you get flogged 100 times. And if you lie about somebody having committed adultery, then the false witness gets 80 lashes. So.
Ah.
Yeah, so don't perjure yourself in that law code. So,
So I think it's misleading. I mean, she said, let me get back up to where she says it. She compares it to all the founders of the great religions, but that kind of means you're just ignoring things like the Code of Hammurabi, which, you know, when you're looking at things that, like I said, a lot of this is just taking all of the stuff that had happened in the past with things like that and just making improvements there. He might have been the best of his time, but I don't think he was the best of history up to that point.
I don't know. So therein lay my bias, but I'm being as objective as I can.
Yeah.
At the end of the day,
I don't really see anything that stands out that makes it seem unusual from anything else that happened in history up to that point.
In many ways, I suppose. One thing to point out, though, is that one big improvement was actually on the subject of murder. For example, in the Codex Hammurabi, in the Law Code of Hammurabi, you tended to pretty much take the eye to for an eye approach.
Right.
In the Quran, it actually states that it's preferable not to kill the person who committed the murder, instead to try to seek some sort of tort, essentially, what's called a diya, which is set by local custom. So traditionally, for a full grown man, it's 100 camels, and then the details about that vary depending on the degree of murder. But there is that, and of course there are the things I mentioned, like, for example, women could at least inherit, if not inherit equally, at least when it comes to daughters. And then, of course, there's the other improvements. But again, as you say, it's incremental. It's
Well, and at least from what I've read, you'd know better than me, so feel free to correct me, but it seems like the things people complain about, like making the women cover their bodies and wearing the headscarf and things like that, was because basically before then, women were paraded around and basically next to nothing and viewed as sex objects, and he was trying to stop that from happening.
Well, the thing is, the Quran itself doesn't actually specify exactly how you're supposed to cover yourself. It only recommends that women dress modestly. And yeah. It's by tradition that a woman wears only needs to wear a headscarf. And that would be the end, and just dress modestly, and that would be the end of the matter. But then you have a tradition that grows around it, you know, where you wear the full burqa and all that stuff, which I find to be pretty absurd. My dad finds it absurd. Everybody in my family finds it absurd. So.
Yeah. but I mean, the point is, you know, you're saying, okay, it's horrible to tell women what to wear and tell them to cover themselves. Yeah, but when you compare it to what was going on before.
Yeah, well, again, I'm not exactly in favor of forcing anything on anyone. And again, the Quran itself is not very specific about what you're supposed to be wearing, except that you're supposed to be modest. That's the main thing that's emphasized. But at the end of the day, this is very much a product of the 7th century. And I believe that Muslims worldwide have to understand that, including, here's the confession time, including myself, and just build up from there and improve on that, go in the right direction. Because at the end of the day, the way I look at it is that the spirit of the law matters a lot more than the actual letter of it. And I feel that for his time, he took a step forward, but he wasn't exactly a figure of the 20th century, if you follow, or 21st century while we're at it.
Yeah, so the bottom line is that there's a lot to criticize in this article, but I think there's enough, of at least of a nugget of truth in there, that I wouldn't say the whole thing is bogus.
Hmm. So, yeah, pretty much. So,
okay, so I guess we'll have to see how many more times Barack Obama can take biggest bogani meter before he leaves office. I add one more this week for his excuses as to why he won't pardon Edward Snowden. He said, quote, "I can't pardon somebody who hasn't gone before a court and presented themselves. And this is absolutely untrue, as everyone who was paying attention in the 70s knows, because Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon and he hadn't even been indicted."
I still think what Gerald Ford did was the wrong move. So
yeah.
But
and it pretty much guaranteed that he would not be properly elected president in 76. But.
Yeah. I don't know. I get the feeling that the politicians in this country, and really worldwide, run on a parallel set of laws. I mean, you have laws for the common man, and then you have laws for the important people, if you follow.
Oh, yeah, we've talked about that quite a lot.
So
different rules for thee than for me.
Yeah, so if Obama wants to basically not prosecute, which I think he should, or at least he should allow it, then... Yeah, I'm not really surprised at this point. I'm very cynical about it. So
yeah. But also, we have pretty good evidence that Obama himself knows he lied, because he pardoned 3 Iranian Americans before they stood trial. So he knows he doesn't have to wait post-conviction.
Oh, he's just trying to be politically correct, you know.
Yeah.
So Look, at the end of the day, Obama has to accept that what Edward Snowden did, okay, I'm sure it must have been embarrassing as shit to the U.S. government, but I don't know. Is it really as bad as lying to your people about why you're going to war or murdering hundreds of people overseas or, I don't know, implementing policies that destroy families and fuck up people's health care?
Yeah, I remember when they were scrimping around to try and find one person who was put in threat of being killed by the Snowden revelations, and they couldn't find anyone.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, this is a symptom of, aside from the fact that there seems to be a parallel set of laws, I mean, on the one hand, they're willing to curb stomp Edward Snowden, but on the other hand, they won't, and this is what I'm referring to, they won't prosecute Hillary Clinton. On the other hand, this shows that governments fundamentally, especially powerful ones, cannot thrive on in the light. They thrive on secrecy. So they don't like having their secrets exposed. So if Edward Snowden releases a document that basically humiliates the U.S. government and exposes it for what it's doing, it's not so much that he's jeopardized national security, it's that he's fundamentally humiliated the U.S. government on some level. So they react accordingly. It's not all that different from the Egyptian government throwing people in jail for criticizing the mythical cure for AIDS that they advertised in the early days of Sisi's rule. So,
yeah. So if you want to know how it actually works, the Supreme Court stated it clearly in Ex Parte Garland, quote, "The power of pardon conferred by the Constitution upon the president is unlimited except in cases of impeachment. It extends to every offense known to the law and may be exercised at any time after its commission, either before legal proceedings are taken or during their pendency or after conviction and judgment. The power is not subject to legislative control. A pardon reaches the punishment prescribed for an offense and the guilt of the offender. If granted before conviction, it prevents any of the penalties and disabilities consequent upon conviction from attaching. If granted after conviction, it removes the penalties and disabilities and restores him to all his civil rights. It gives him a new credit and capacity. There is only this limitation to its operation. It does not restore offices forfeited or property of interests vested in others in consequence of the conviction and judgment."
And of course, Obama knows this because he was a constitutional law professor, as I recall.
Yeah, you know, that's easy to forget for some reason.
Yeah, so biggest bogon emitter? Definitely.
Yeah, one more time for Barack Obama.
Yeah, just for old time's sake, I suppose. You know what I'm surprised about, though? It's been several months since this all started, and okay, he's gotten a few, Hillary's gotten a few, but Trump has yet to get one.
I think he'll be getting some in the future. That's my prediction. So,
I'm really hoping so.
I'm confident it won't be too long after he takes office that we'll be all over him.
The sad thing is, as I understand it, he keeps losing the BBE or IE awards simply because
there's even more stupid things going on by other people.
It's amazing. I mean, he consistently says stupid things, but he's never the most stupid person in the room. And I think that's the key to being a president.
I think if you look at the overall quantity of stupid, he's up there. But if you look at each of the things that he says and does in isolation, you know, it doesn't really reach the levels we see from other people on an individual basis. Okay, idiot extraordinaire. Sorry, no echo this week. We don't have Daniel here either to do his, so. But this week it's Jason Easley who has the proof that Jill Stein and Gary Johnson cost Hillary the election. And not, you know, Hillary being an unprincipled criminal scumbag or anything like that.
Wait. I want to have this run by because, as you know, I'm a registered libertarian voter, and I do take part in Libertarian Party affairs from time to time, albeit on the fringe. You know, I'm nothing important. But I'm aware of the actual voter turnouts in several of the western states where I live. And in Utah, Trump won, and the libertarian the amount of libertarian voters was reasonably high. It was about 3%. In Colorado, it was even higher than that. It was about 4 to 5%. And bear in mind, Colorado has more people than Utah, so that gives you an idea of just how many people voted libertarian over there. Guess who won the state of Colorado?
Was that Trump?
No, Hillary did.
Oh, that was Hillary.
Nope. So I really, and this is the largest third party candidate. I mean, he was way ahead of even Jill Stein. I simply fail to see how he is capable of stealing the votes from Hillary. And this becomes even more farcical when one remembers that, in effect, Hillary did win the popular vote, albeit by the slimmest of margins. So certainly slim enough to give Democrats the excuse to cook up this nonsense about the need for voter recounts in some of the swing states or battleground states. So
yeah, but just the ones where Hillary lost.
Huh?
But just the ones where Hillary lost.
Exactly. So, which tells you their motive about the whole thing. I mean, they're not really there to make sure that things are kept honest. They're there to basically give Trump the middle finger and undermine his credibility. Because let's be honest, I mean, in those states, Hillary didn't exactly lose by a very small margin. She lost by a pretty comfortable one, though still a small margin. And so the voter recount's probably going to return the same result. And at the end of the day, all that's going to achieve is that it's going to make Trump look bad in front of the eyes of certain people. And in the eyes of others, including you and me, of course, it's going to make the Democrats look like even bigger scumbags. So. Yeah.
And check out this remark from Easley, quote, Hillary Clinton got nadered. Yes, they're trying to make that a verb now.
Nadered.
Nadered, referring to Ralph Nader.
Yeah, I know.
Taking the election from Al Gore in the year 2000.
Yeah, everybody mispronounces the poor man's name. he's a Lebanese Arab in descent, so his name is actually Nader. So,
but I think he pronounces it Nader, doesn't he?
Yeah, it's anglicized. So. Yeah.
But let's go ahead and put this one to rest. Yeah. If Al Gore had taken his home state of Tennessee, he would have won. If he'd taken Bill Clinton's home state of Arkansas, he would have won. Ralph Nader didn't lose it for Al Gore. Al Gore lost it for Al Gore. But just like now, we're seeing how little Democrats want to take personal responsibility.
I know. And actually, this calls to mind, I'm not going to name names here, but it calls to mind some of the strongly Democratic voters in my graduate school who, on hearing that Trump had won, basically started crying, literally, and exclaiming how Trump's victory was because everybody who voted for him was a racist and shit. So,
yeah.
It's this strange inability to take responsibility, which I find quite amusing.
Yeah. All right, so here's his proof. Quote, in Florida, Hillary Clinton lost by about 1.4% of the vote. But if Jill Stein supporters and half of Gary Johnson's backers had voted Democratic, Trump would have lost the state. Similarly, in Pennsylvania, Clinton lost by about 1.1% of the vote. But if Jill Stein supporters and half of Gary Johnson's backers had voted Democratic, Trump would have lost the state. In Wisconsin, Clinton lost by about 1%. But if Stein supporters had voted Democratic, Trump would have lost. In Michigan, Clinton appears to be on track to lose by about 0.3% of the vote. But if half of Stein supporters had voted Democratic, Trump would have lost the state. There's an awful lot of ifs there for a proof.
Yeah, especially let's take this to its logical conclusion, shall we? Let's go back to Colorado. If everybody who voted Libertarian voted for Hillary Clinton, Hillary would have still won Colorado. And if they had decided to vote for Trump, then Colorado would have gone to Trump. There were that many. Yeah. So it could have gone either way.
Well, also there's a little bit of an omission here. Like if Jill Stein supporters and half of Gary Johnson's backers voted Democratic, Trump would have lost the state. But he's not including what the other half of Gary Johnson's voters would have done. If they had voted Trump, that would have put Trump back over the top. So I guess we make the assumptions we want. Jill Stein supporters and half of Gary Johnson's backers would have voted Hillary. The rest of them wouldn't have voted at all, and none of them would have voted Trump.
Well, frankly, all this is idle speculation at the end of the day, because we can't really know the motives of every last voter who voted for X or Y candidate. And just for the record, I mean, I voted for Gary Johnson in the presidential election, and I voted for John, King of England, as governor of Utah. Both, about Gary Johnson, well, I was going to vote for him reluctantly, as it happens, no matter what the situation was. I mean, because I don't want to vote either for Trump or Hillary. I mean, I'll be honest, I think both of them are a bunch of clowns. So, criminal clowns, but clowns nonetheless. So... yeah, so at the end of the day, and this is just me as an example, and there are no doubt hundreds of thousands of people who, even if they didn't vote for Gary Johnson, it doesn't necessarily mean that they were going to vote for Hillary or for Trump. So this demonstrates that our esteemed gentleman here, who has just won this lovely award, has basically fallen into the trap of a false dichotomy. It's either one or the other. Well, who said?
So yeah, but I mean, you can really see his bias with some of the quotes here. Like he says, quote, "The media spent more than a year making the false equivalency that Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server was the same as Donald Trump's sexual assaults."
Yeah. I think he has it backwards, but the fact of the matter is, okay.
Well, it's not use of a private email server. It's complete mismanagement of a private email server that contained classified documents and that...
Which brings up the typical question in Egyptian Arabic or Palestinian Arabic, "Eshli wadehnek." I mean, what brought the emails to these private servers? What are they doing there?
Yeah.
A government person uses government emails for a reason. I mean, not that it's that much in the way of protection, as you know, but you use that kind of email for a reason. All right.
And what are Donald Trump's sexual assaults other than just locker room talk, which probably half the men in America have done?
Yeah. You know, well, I don't know if it's half necessarily, but yeah. And that's the other thing. I actually remember thinking this prior to the election. I'm thinking, okay, both of them are equally deplorable. But when I think about it, okay, the biggest scandal about Hillary are her emails and all that other funky stuff as Secretary of State. And the biggest thing about Donald Trump is that he talked about grabbing pussy.
Yeah.
So, when you think about it, which one is objectively worse? For some reason, talking about, okay, it's disgusting, I'm sure, but at the end of the day, he's only talking about it. As far as we know, he may not even be telling the truth. It may be just hot air. All right.
Yeah, who knows?
It probably isn't. I mean, the guy is a serial philanderer, but...
yeah. But at the same time, I don't really trust a word that comes out of the guy's mouth.
Yeah, I mean, this is the same guy who, prior to the election, said, "Well, one of the first things I'll do is repeal Obamacare," and then afterwards he's like, "Oh, we'll just compromise it."
Yeah.
So, reminds me of the Muslim Brotherhood before they were elected. The BOT system is usury and therefore un-Islamic. After election, the BOT is just administrative expenses. No big deal.
Now, what's the BOT?
It's BUT or BOT, depending on how you render it. It's a type of monetary system that they have in Egypt and in a lot of banks worldwide. I forget the exact details of it, but it's basically a type of interest. So,
So
there was a big scandal about it and everything back in the day. So,
So Easley writes, quote, "Congratulations, third-party voters who thought they were protesting system. You just got Donald Trump elected. Please enjoy the 4 years of your worst nightmares that you brought to life through your own arrogant and self-righteous stupidity."
Wow. If he projects any harder, he just might reach the Hubble Deep Field. Just might. So, I mean, really? Really, look, I'm not being self-righteous here. I simply can't bring myself to vote for either Trump or Hillary. I really don't want anything to do with them. And I suspect many people who vote for Gary Johnson did so for the same reason. And has it ever occurred to him that, aside from that, some people may actually believe in what Gary Johnson says and may have voted for him simply because they agree with him? I mean, that's not self-righteousness. That's just... hey, I like this guy. I agree with him. Let's vote for him.
Yeah, if there weren't Gary Johnson or some other kind of libertarian on the ballot, I probably wouldn't have voted for anyone for president.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I would have voted for John, King of England, but I'm a prankster. So, so vote for John. He will ring you tight.
Sounds cute.
And actually, the reason I did that, and I explained it to some people here, is that it's really a very cynical commentary on the nature of government these days. That a man who in the Middle Ages was famed for his corruption, brutality, and his talent for wringing people dry of money is, when you read about his actual exploits objectively, would make a far better president than either the two clowns who ran for office this year, or the clown who was there before, or the year before, or the year before, and so on.
Sadly, this is probably true.
Yeah, and also the funny part is he's their ancestor. He's the ancestor of everybody who's ever been president except for Martin Van Buren.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they're being shown up by their own ancestor. So.
And all the toilets in the land are named after him.
Yeah. So, for example, when John raised taxes, it was actually so that he can get his lands back in France. All right. When people over here raise taxes, it's so that they could spend it on their pet projects. So when John squeezed the barons, it's because it was actually out of a perverted sense of justice. He believed he was bringing justice to people by enacting laws that put pressure on the barons and put them under control, because barons were kind of a bunch of assholes in those days. When people do the same over here, it's so that they can protect the equivalent to the barons. Does that tell you something?
Mm-hmm.
So bear in mind, I don't like John. He's an asshole. He was an asshole. All right. And yet he, every day, the more I learn about Trump or Hillary or Obama while we're at it, the more I think he would make a far better president than these guys. So, and I'm being entirely facetious, of course, but you get my point.
Yeah.
So
all of that makes Jason Easley this week's idiot extraordinaire. Okay, that's it for this week. Sorry, I don't have a formal bow out, but I did come up with a quote for this week. Remember, no podcast this weekend. There'll be one or two more regular podcasts before the holidays. Still not sure which. I'll let you know. Also, there are going to be some changes coming to the YouTube channel for the new year, so keep an eye out for that. I hope you'll like it.
Oh, wait, aren't we going to talk about the Egyptian channel?
Oh, that's right. You had that video.
Oh.
Yeah. Tell us about the video.
Oh, okay. This is going to be funny. This is really, we'll just put it in there as a blooper. Yeah, so what happened was a week ago, and this was reported on the Joe Show, which is a satirical show, but kind of like most satirical shows here, it's more accurate than most news. He reported about the economic situation in Egypt. People are having trouble finding food. Inflation's galloping all over the place. The government is completely impotent to stop any of this, and in fact, it's probably making it worse and all that stuff. So what does the news media say? Does it call out the president, Sisi, for being an idiot? That's option A. Option B, does it say nothing? Or option C, does it basically tell people that they shouldn't complain because everybody else has the same problem around the world? If you picked C, you just won the made a full grade on that particular question.
So what was he saying?
The news media in Egypt was saying to stop complaining about the corruption, the lack of food, the inflation, and all that, because countries all over the world have them.
Countries all over the world have food or have a lack of food?
Lack of food.
Oh, okay.
Countries all over the world have corruption, therefore it's not a big deal. Countries all over the world have food shortages, not a big deal. You know. And the best part was this lady who was dressed in golden jewelry that glinted so hard you could see it on the screen, telling people, "Oh, it's not the economy that's important; it's our dignity." So, yeah, tell that to the average starving Egyptian.
Yeah, so, that kind of sounds like what they say here.
Yeah. So, and the other very close second place is when. One news anchor after another, and it's as if they're all reading from the same script, to be honest. I mean, I could talk about any number of them.
They probably are.
Yeah. And what they keep also saying that the food shortage isn't bad because, for example, Britain underwent the same type of rationing during World War II. Of course, this was pointed out by both Joe on the Joe Show. Joe is just the Anglicization of his name, Yusuf. He pointed out that, well, Britain was at war. When was the last time Egypt was at war? It's been a while. They shouldn't be having rationing and stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, I wanted to talk about that basically as a reminder to the people watching this that bogosity isn't just confined to the United States. I mean, most of what we do is stuff in the United States, stuff people here do, or in Europe to a lesser extent, but it's just as bad in the Near East. So
yeah, we try to cover as much of the world as we can, but
yeah, no, it's not your fault or anything. I'm not saying that, but inevitably, because
yeah, it's just good. Like if you weren't here to speak Arabic for us, we wouldn't know that that video even existed, much less what it said. Because these things generally don't get reported that much in the English language.
Yeah, and more importantly, and this is the other thing I want to bring up, is that I see way too much of the stuff that's common in the Arab world nowadays beginning to happen here. Like the attitude of shut up and stop complaining. It could be worse. So I'm starting to see that very same attitude. So and the thing is, when you grow up being told that it could be worse and that you shouldn't be complaining and all that, you stop just giving a shit, really. It sucks out the initiative from you, the life from society. So
yeah.
Pretty depressing stuff, but.
But there we are. As different as people are all over, they're alike in so many ways.
Well, we are all of the same species. We have less diversity genetically than a troop of chimpanzees. That should tell you something.
Yep.
So, yeah. That's all I had to say.
So this week's quote is from John Perry Barlow. I'm embarrassed for my country in that in my entire voting life, there has never been a major party candidate whom I felt I could vote for.
Taking the words right out of my mouth.
Yep. This podcast is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. Bye-bye.